This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Derek walks you through how to win government jobs and contracts, effectively manage your government career, and best utilize government services. Every week on Fed Access, you'll learn about interesting federal agencies, workers, and jobs. Fed Access provides you the access you need to succeed in the federal government. And now your host, Derek T. Dortch.
Welcome to Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch on Federal News Radio 1500. Thank you for dropping by the show. Today, we're going to be talking about some serious issues that are going on abroad. Libya, Cairo, other areas, Egypt. We've had our embassies attacked. We've unfortunately lost an ambassador, and we pray for him, his family, and all those who were lost in the recent attacks of our consulate. But we have these issues going on overseas, and we're wondering how safe are our embassies, how safe are our consulates, but also how safe are American companies and how safe are American citizens abroad, especially as they're going over to the Middle East, North Africa, or any kind of conflict region. Today, we're talking to Fred Burton. He's a vice president of Stratfor. They're a global geopolitical kind of risk security consulting type firm, and they do a lot of analysis on what's going on around the world. They've been covering this very, very closely, and Fred has a unique experience about this because he used to work for State Department in the Bureau of Diplomatic Security, being the head of the deputy director of their counterterrorism unit. So Fred knows these issues uniquely from his standpoint of working in that area. Fred, thank you for coming on the show.
Oh, thank you for having me, Derek.
Fred, you know, this situation and unfortunate loss, people keep on asking the question, one, are our embassies safe? Two, was this a situation that there was a lack of security, or it was just basically an unfortunate kind of caught off guard scenario? You know, people keep on asking, are there enough Marines around and everything else? And I know when I was in the Marine Corps, we used to plan for these situations. We used to do a lot of training about going into an embassy and evacuating the embassy and things like that. What do you think the current situation is?
Well, first and foremost, Derek, it is the host government's responsibility to provide a safe and secure environment for our diplomats that are stationed overseas. And unfortunately, in Benghazi, you had an infrastructure that was not robust enough by the host government to protect the diplomats, compounded by a temporary facility under waivers, which is very, very important. It's not an embassy. It's not a consulate. It's a temporary facility, meaning the State Department has determined that the needs of the Foreign Service dictated that we had to be there. Therefore, certain security requirements are not mandated by law. We learned our lessons over the years on how to protect embassies after the horrific embassy bombings in Beirut in 83 and 84, and then certainly the bombings in Africa. So in essence, these kinds of outposts in places like Benghazi are very, very vulnerable. And
Fred, let me interject real quick. Is that situation with these waivers, because it would take a massive amount of time, energy, and resources and money and everything else to build a full-blown-out embassy in Benghazi, and sometimes we don't have the time to wait to put diplomats on the ground. Is that true?
That's correct, and there lies the rub, meaning, in essence, the Diplomatic Security Service, my old organization, is consistently placed literally between a rock and a hard place at times, trying to do the best they can to protect diplomats so they can do their job. It's like everything else in the government. Everything's fine until there's usual catastrophe, then people are asking questions. But at the end of the day, our protection mandate, the Diplomatic Security Service's protection mandate, because of the requirements to protect diplomats in places like Iraq since the military has withdrawn, well, the DSS is responsible for protecting everybody running around the country that are official Americans. So that's an extraordinarily large resource problem for the service. So what happens is And you can understand this having been in the government. You have a series of temporary assignments where you send agents out to do, in this case, in Benghazi, 45-day temporary protection requirements. So the agents are, in essence, rotated in and out, and their sole function is to protect the chief of mission and the facilities there.
You know, with that, and you just kind of talked about kind of that story, because usually on any, and of course not to reveal any kind of security dynamic, but usually diplomatic security has a small, I mean, they're small but well-trained contingent. And even with the Marine Security Detachment, and like you said, the host government is really in charge of, just like we protect the embassies here, because, you know, we have Secret Service and DS, you know, and diplomatic security people outside embassies here. They're supposed to be kind of watching out for our embassies in other countries. And so we keep a small detail. It's not like we have hundreds and hundreds of soldiers or Marines walking or security people walking around. Is that true?
That's correct. Now there's a U.S. Marine FAST team in after the fact, but before the incident, we did not have a Marine Security Guard detachment, which, as you know, are outstanding physical security augmentation for the facility in Benghazi on the day of the attack, which appears to be a very serious al-Qaeda-led pre-planned operation.
Mm-hmm.
So in essence, our limited staff there were literally hunkered down trying to do the best they can, greatly outnumbered and certainly overwhelmed once the attack began, which included at least five mortars that were launched at our facility as we were trying to get the Americans out of there.
Do you think it was a more of a situation of just truth? I mean, not enough intelligence being given, or it's and things happen sometimes. I mean, even as much as we prepare, sometimes things will happen, and it's not the fault of a security detail or anything like that. Do you think it was just more of a situation of being just completely caught off guard? The intel wasn't there. What do you think it is, Fred?
Well, the State Department must convene what is called an accountability review board. Again, whenever there's loss of life or loss of serious property damage, it's mandated by Congress that a review board examines exactly what took place. And that's ran concurrent with the FBI criminal investigation, which is worked jointly by the Diplomatic Security Service and the FBI. So I think what is going to come out of that, Derek. It's been my experience in dealing with these kinds of reviews in previous tragedies, is they'll look at certain things. For example, why was the ambassador there on the anniversary of 9/11? I don't know the answer to that question, meaning could he have been hunkered down in Tripoli? Would that have been a better place for him to be? They'll look at things such as, there was a local guard force that, again, is a contract State Department entity. In this case, that local guard force was unarmed and was operating under a UK contract. They'll look at the capabilities and the training of the guard force. Then they'll look at other things, such as what intelligence was known on that given day. We have seen some of the reports that have come out of the national news media that Ambassador Stevens himself has stated that he was on some sort of al-Qaeda hit list. Well, if that's the case, common sense certainly dictates, well, why is he there to begin with, and then why is he there on 9/11?
Right.
So those are the kinds of questions. Those are tough questions that somebody at the State Department is going to have to answer. But I also think it's important that folks understand this, that as the president's representative for that country, he is overall, Ambassador Stevens, responsible for the safety and the security of all official Americans in country. So there lies the problem. In essence, the agents that are assigned to protect him, which are usually very junior agents, are in essence working for their boss, and they are in no position to countermand what decisions he might make.
I was just about to ask you that question. As an ambassador, you know, this personnel, the security detail can say, "Ambassador, possibly we possibly shouldn't go there." But can the ambassador override their authority and say, "Listen, I want to go when you guys just make arrangements"? I mean, is that how it works with an ambassador? I mean, because ambassadors usually have a great deal of kind of power and latitude in the country that they're working for. Is that how it works?
That's how it works. There's certainly back-channel kinds of communications that are always taking place. The diplomatic security service agents, in essence, have to report to two masters through their reporting chain of command back to Washington, as well as that U.S. ambassador in country. But as you and I both know, that doesn't get you very far if you're going to try to pick up the phone and report on activities that Post would very much like to keep from Washington at times. And I don't know if that took place in this case, but I do know this, that if in fact the ambassador had been on an al-Qaeda hit list, it doesn't make good sense for him to have been in Benghazi on the anniversary of 9/11. And we don't know what hit list that was, how old that was, how fresh that intelligence was. And you also touched on something, Derek, that I think is important. What intelligence was known prior to this to indicate that an attack was in the works?
Right. Right. You know, we take a quick break, Fred. When we come back, I want to kind of keep on that. But I want to travel into the sector of our American interests in terms of our commercial interests. I know you guys deal a lot with some of the American Fortune 500 companies who have operations overseas. But in terms of our American interests, we've seen some of our companies, KFC, Hardee's, and other things like that. Their places have been overran and burnt down, and some of them have closed down in those regions. You know, what's the threat to them? And then also, what's the threat to any kind of American citizens, as, you know, they may be overseas as well? We'll talk about when we come back. We're talking to Fred Burton. He is the Vice President of Intelligence for Stratfor. You can find them at stratfor.com. They are a geopolitical risk, security, and intelligence type firm that does a lot of analysis worldwide, is covering this issue and many other issues that we'll try to touch upon today. We'll be right back after this break. You're listening to Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome to Fed Access. This is Derek T. Dortch. You're listening to Fed Access with me right now. We're talking to Fred Burton. He is a Vice President of Intelligence at Stratfor. You can find their website at stratfor.com. But we're talking about a number of different issues. And in the first area, the first segment, we talked about what was going on in Libya, in a dynamic where our ambassador was lost, the security situation, the embassies, and everything else. And Fred is an expert on this. Stratfor covers this, but Fred has a unique background in this, that he used to work for the Diplomatic Security Service for the State Department as their Deputy Director for Counterterrorism, and he dealt with a number of these issues at one time. Fred, when we're looking at security overall, though, should Americans be concerned? I mean, of course, we got to be concerned, but for the overall security at our embassies, for the most part, is pretty good. Would you say that?
Absolutely. There's no doubt that the Diplomatic Security Service does a wonderful job in protecting our facilities across the globe in very, very difficult circumstances at times.
You know, with that, you know, and is the same security level for consulates, or and I guess, and maybe you can kind of shine some light on this, in terms of a consulate, are consulates kind of more of a smaller kind of regional office, if we thought about kind of a headquarters, and then we think about maybe a regional office, and then are consulates put out in areas of conflict, or are consulates more put out in areas that are stable?
Well, it really depends upon the geography and the country. For example, you'll have the U.S. Embassy, Islamabad, Pakistan. Then you'll have consulates in Karachi and Lahore. And that's a perfect example of the challenges of protecting diplomats in Pakistan with the Mohammed, the cartoon recent flare-up, as well as the Mohammed film, where you'll have, at times, 50,000 demonstrators protesting at a facility where the host government has to roll out the military in order to prevent a mob violence kind of seizure. And we saw that unfold in Cairo before the Benghazi attack. And, of course, Pakistan suffered greatly with the mob violence, and protecting these facilities becomes a real challenge. You really need the host government to step up with an overwhelming force to prevent a facility seizure. In 1979, the U.S. Embassy in Islamabad, Pakistan, was overran and ransacked by mob violence and, in essence, burned the embassy to the ground. But in both of those structures, Derek, in a U.S. consulate or a U.S. embassy, there are standard security requirements with setback distance, ballistic window film, the ability to survive a vehicle-borne improvised explosive device, hardened safe rooms, evacuation plans, marine security guards that can help you defend armed attacks, for example. The real challenge today in what some is describing as these transformational democracy areas or these outposts like Benghazi is, how do you adequately protect these diplomats that are in these areas for whatever purpose, the needs of the Foreign Service, intelligence collection purposes, how do you protect them in these kinds of outposts, which is exactly what happened in Benghazi, and that's the real challenge.
You know, as you think about it, because it's almost a balance, and I think you were talking about this in the first segment, the balance of between having a diplomat in a fort-like structure hunkered down and then having a diplomat who's able to get out and do diplomacy. And that's probably the unique balance of kind of diplomacy and security, would you say?
Absolutely, and that's where the real challenge is. It takes a tremendous amount of people skills to work in these environments, and at times there's a love-hate relationship with the Diplomatic Security Service, because you can't eliminate all risk, but there are certain things that you can do to greatly reduce that risk at times. Having said that, the diplomats always want to go to meetings and get out and do their speeches and so forth, and that's where the challenge is protecting these individuals as they move about on the perimeter, and to prevent not only these kinds of horrific facility seizures, but just general attacks on motorcades or pre-planned assassinations, and all the other tragedies that have happened to the U.S. Foreign Service overseas.
You know, there was this talk about Al-Qaeda, you know, sometimes Al-Qaeda being dead or close to dead, this, that, and the other. Would you say that this attack is kind of a wake-up call that we should not have, we shouldn't count them or any kind of extremist or terrorist organization, not just Al-Qaeda, the Al-Qaeda Prime, but AQAP, AQIM, you know, all the different spinoff branches of Al-Qaeda and other terrorist organizations or extremist-type groups. I'm assuming that you would probably say it's not time to count them out.
No, I don't think you can certainly count them out. They still remain, as evidenced by Benghazi, a very dangerous kind of entity. And it's going to be very, very interesting to see the component members of this group and where they're from and their nationalities in the event that the FBI and the CIA and the State Department's able to identify the actual perpetrators of this event. It's going to be very, very interesting to just see that and to see what other kinds of attacks they've carried out in the past. I think that at the end of the day, it just shows you the challenges at times in these places that spring up and can literally haunt you at times out of nowhere. And I think some of the tough questions that the Accountability Review Board really has to look at is, how did this occur? How come we had no intelligence this was going to unfold? And I also am very intrigued about Ambassador Stevens' comments himself, allegedly, that he was on an Al-Qaeda hit list. Well, which list was that, and when did that come out?
Right. This brings to my question, Fred. Do we need a new counterterrorism strategy. We're doing a good job in terms of drone attacks, and we definitely have, you know, cut down a number of the leaders and things like that. But I think about these countries and where these attacks at, and it seems as if the common aspects of each country is that we've got these high unemployment rates, we've got people who are in despair, you know, governments that they hate, or that they're, you know, that there's a lot of transformation going on, a lack of democracy, or people are, you know, are not happy in a number of different ways. Do we need a new counterterrorism strategy that's not just a dynamic of killing terrorists, but also a dynamic of boosting the economies of these countries to where, you know, if, and I don't know if it's just us, but if people are working, then you'd be less likely to maybe do a demonstration or become a terrorist. If you have economic stability, then you're less likely to be persuaded to get into this thing. Do we need to add that into a counterterrorism strategy?
Well, I think very much so. I think as you look at this kind of environment, it certainly doesn't create itself in a vacuum that you're going to have these kinds of geopolitical sensitivities as well as the economic ramifications in some of these nations, especially where you've had a dictator like Gaddafi that's been in charge for so many years, and all of a sudden the genie is out of the bottle. It affords all kinds of different kinds of challenges. I mean, think about it. You've got border security issues. Well, there really isn't any. You've got document and identity kind of fraud issues. Well, how are you even going to conduct basic record checks? You've got no ability to control weapons and weapons smuggling and so forth in the country. So it's almost like a swamp and a breeding ground for these kinds of activities to percolate up out of, and it takes a very, very robust intelligence collection effort to stay on top of that, which again then causes like the CIA and the National Intelligence Community to start looking at these areas, and DIA to focus in on them, to start looking for man pads and weapons that could fall into the hands of Al-Qaeda to go after civil aviation. So, you know, the range of problems that can percolate out of one of these kinds of environments, whether it be Syria or Libya today, is just daunting.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Fred, I want to come back. When we get to the next segment, we got to take a quick break. We can talk about this all day. I want to get into the commercial side for sure on the next break, commercial and individuals, because I know for some people, I even know who are going to Egypt before the year is out. Is that a safe thing to do right now if people are thinking about going to trips in that part of the world? I want to talk about that. And also for commercial firms, what's the impact of their security as well? We'll talk about that when we come back. We're talking to Fred Burton. He is the Vice President of Intelligence at Stratfor. You can find them at stratfor.com. They're a geopolitical and risk and security consulting and intelligence gathering firm. Deals with the private sector, deals with the government, but they have a lot of good stuff on their website that you'll find useful. We'll be right back after this break. You're listening to Fed Access with Derek T. Deutsch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome to Fed Access with Derek T. Deutsch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. If you're just joining us, we've been having an interesting conversation about the security of our embassies, the security of consulates, what happened in Libya and Benghazi, what happened with the situation with Ambassador Stevens. Is our embassy safe? We've concluded the majority of our embassies are safe, but there are definitely a number of daunting issues that we have to deal with in many countries overseas. Our diplomatic security service is doing a great job, but they do have to contend with a number of different issues. We're talking to Fred Burton. He's a Vice President of Intelligence at Stratfor. They are a geopolitical risk security kind of consulting firm, intelligence gathering. They gather a lot of information about what's going on in various regions, not only in the Middle East, Africa, but all around the world. And you can find them at stratfor.com. Fred also, just to let people know if you just joined us, he also used to be Deputy Director of Counterterrorism at the Diplomatic Security Service. So he knows these issues firsthand. Fred, for Americans who are not diplomats, the commercial side, individuals who may be thinking about going to Egypt was always a big tourist spot at one point in time. People who are still thinking about going over there. Is this a good time?
Well, there lies the rub. You have to really make an effort to individually look at the official government websites, whether it be the State Department's travel advisories and local security and emergency notices. The United Kingdom has a very good website as well that monitors security events in certain countries. You have to empower yourself with information to make sure you're on top of things, and you don't want to put yourself in an environment where you could get caught up in either an anti-American demonstration, which at this moment in time, with all the unrest in the Middle East, would be one of the primary concerns. So my advice and counsel would be do your research before you travel. Make sure that the place you're going to doesn't have demonstrations or are under State Department advisories, and make sure that you have good plans to get in and out of the country in the event of emergency, and that loved ones know how to reach you and so forth. So it's really going to be dependent upon where you're traveling to and trying to stay on top of local media and radio and papers to just stay informed. And at times, don't hesitate to reach out to that respective U.S. embassy or consulate and say, you know, I'm an American citizen, I'm here, I'm just curious as to the security environment. Is it a good time to come? Do you have any recommendations on hotels that are better than others? And embassies are there to help you, and they will help you with that kind of advice.
So really, they can reach out. I know there's a RSO, a regional security officer, in every embassy, and there are different people. They can, a citizen can reach out individually to State Department and look on the website, but possibly even call down and kind of say, hey, listen, what's the security situation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. For a person who may have bought tickets before these things happen, because sometimes people plan these international trips long in advance, and was thinking about going to Egypt, you know, it, for that person, and they're seeing these kind of things, you know, break out, do you think that a person should say, hey, listen, and will airlines work with them on that? I don't know what your experience is on that, Fred, but do you think a person should kind of reassess and say, hey, maybe it's not the time right now, let me let things kind of calm down? Because is the truth of it is, are Americans probably still one of the highest targets for possible terrorism or attack if they go into these kind of environments?
Well, I think, again, that's going to be very dependent upon your location. For example, if you're inbound to Cairo for a specific kind of tour, most of the travel agencies and tour groups have a pretty good handle on the local situation, and depending upon the kind of package that you've purchased, you're able to at times postpone those kinds of events. What I think it's best to do is to not go into these kinds of things blinded by just traveling, but positively reach out and look at these websites such as the www.state.gov and search under that respective country. Our website has a lot of information as well that folks can look at, and there's other kinds of commercial services that can do that as well. And then don't hesitate to reach out to the U.S. Embassy if you're in country and you have some concerns. You know, think about where you're staying. You know, maintain a good sense of awareness. If you start seeing a demonstration or things that just don't look right, get out of the area quickly and just look for a place to hunker down for a while. And that's the best kind of advice. But it first starts with information, and make sure you're armed with all the information you have.
With American commercial interests, I mentioned that we saw KFC and Hardee's kind of being attacked, at least the installation. I don't necessarily know if any employees were hurt. But for American companies, is this a bad time, you know, to be in certain regions? I mean, they have to worry about the same kind of dynamics of security of their people, security of their facilities, and everything else. I mean, you know, are you hearing that they're very, very concerned about their security, and they're doing the same kind of threat analysis?
Well, for the most part, most of your Fortune 500 companies that are operating in some of these areas, they have full-time security officers and local nationals that are monitoring the pulse and the beat, and they're able to provide internal guidance to employees. And It's not unusual at times for companies to say, look, let's do some temporary holds on travel until things kind of quiet down in places like Cairo where we had the demonstrations.
Mm-hmm.
Like Friday, we're supposed to see some more demonstrations in Pakistan. Well, that would not be the kind of time that would be best to go about to try to do some business in the country anyway at this moment in time. So perhaps it's best if you're bound for Pakistan to just reassess whether or not you're going to go. Egypt is a very big country, and Cairo is a big city, so it's really going to be dependent upon the kind of nature of your business in country and so forth. But most of the huge corporations that we do work with will have very robust travel guidance, primarily due to liability reasons, because they don't want to put their employees into dangerous situations that could come back to haunt them as a company.
Right. So, I mean, and you mentioned a good piece about Egypt being a big country, and so sometimes when we're seeing something happen in a certain kind of region and we're seeing it on TV, it may be that this happened kind of in an isolated dynamic, and doesn't mean it always is, but it may not mean that it's affecting the whole country where the pyramids are or other areas where there are tourist sites. I mean, you kind of have to find that kind of information out, would you say?
Absolutely. What we've seen with the recent Mohammed film protests have been primarily the United States Embassy or consulate in those respective countries have been the focal points for most of the anti-American demonstrations. And then we have seen the sporadic violence in some of the more commercial fast food kind of areas, depending upon the country. And there were a number of countries that were affected that really didn't make the mainstream news as well. Indonesia, for example, and other countries that saw large demonstrations and sporadic violence that broke out. So you would not necessarily just be destined for Egypt or Pakistan at this moment in time for problems to be there. So really, you have to make an aggressive effort to empower yourself with knowledge before you travel.
Definitely. Fred, we're going to take a quick break. When I come back, we got some stuff going on in Mexico, and I know you follow that at Stratfor a lot. I want to talk about these cartels and talk about what's going on there. Always a very, very problematic issue right on our border. And I want to kind of go into depth and get a situation report on that when we come back. We're talking to Fred Burton. He is the Vice President of Intelligence at Stratfor. You can find him at Stratfor.com. They're a geopolitical intelligence gathering, risk, security. They deal with all the different issues of crisis around the world. Got a lot of great stuff on their website, Stratfor.com. We'll be right back after this break. You're listening to Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. If you're just joining us, we have been talking about basically the security situation overseas, talking about the security of our embassies, of our consulates, the security of our American commercial interests, security of yourself if you're planning to go overseas anytime soon, making sure that you take a look at state.gov and other sites to ensure that the country that you're going to is safe and sound, or the region, the other part of that country you're going to is safe and sound, and make security arrangements or cancel your trip if it's not where you should be going at this time. We're talking to Fred Burton. He's been giving us a lot of good advice. He comes from Stratfor. He's the Vice President of Intelligence there. You can find their site at Stratfor.com. They deal with a number of different crisis areas around the world, reporting on intelligence, reporting on what's going on in those areas. Fred, you know, we talk about Mexico all the time, and every time I have you on the show, because I don't see it getting the attention that it probably should get. A lot of stuff is going on, a lot of killings, the cartels are always doing something kind of crazy. What's the current situation right now?
Well, Mexico has been, throughout this past 18 months, probably the number one requested topic on our website, as well as for some of our custom analysis that we have put together by companies or individuals looking for to make sense out of what's taking place there. And literally what's happening there, the scope of violence across the country is very widespread. And traditional areas where we've seen that have been somewhat safe, we're also seeing elements of violence and cartel-related activity, such as in the outskirts of Mexico City. The Zetas and the Gulf Cartel are at war with each other over territory and geography. You have the Sinaloa cartel, which is also one of the largest cartels in country that are battling for these very lucrative supply chain routes into the United States. So, in essence, the fight is very much over turf and geography as you get closer and closer to the border. We've also seen violence in some of the resort areas because either the cartels are using those areas for safe havens or part of their money laundering operations. So, again, much like we were talking about the Middle East, if you're traveling to Mexico, either for tourism or business, it's very important to arm yourself with current information as to where are the current hotspots in country, which is very, very difficult to keep your finger on that pulse because they're very sporadic and they can pop up pretty much anywhere inside the country. We've had a rash of recent brutal killings and hangings. The Mexican government has picked up some high-value targets within the Zeta organization. So it's one of these kinds of situations that it's really hard to get your arms around because there's so much chaos inside the country.
You know, with all of that, in terms of the cartels, and I know we always talk about the they're always, you know, fighting over territory. Would you say that the situation is continuously deteriorating? Has it stabilized? I know there was talk about, you know, more of a military presence in some places. What are we looking at right now?
Well, our forecasting for Mexico is it doesn't bode well over the near future. We don't anticipate with the presidential shift, any change in cartel tactics. You have a double-edged sword here because whenever you move the military into certain areas, that at times increases the cartel-related activity and violence as the military fights the cartels. Hmm. And then left to their own vices, you have the cartels fighting each other. The interesting dynamic, Derek, is when you look at no violence around the plazas, the points of entries, the international bridges coming into the United States, that usually is indicative of cartel control of that very lucrative plaza where the dope moves north and the stolen cars and the bulk cash moves south and the weapons move south. So it's really one of these counterintuitive kind of processes. So the absence of violence doesn't necessarily mean that there's no cartels there. That simply means that the cartels have controlled that geography.
So it's almost as if they have the cartels have a police state and they don't have any competition. So there is no need to fight it out between anybody. And so the peacefulness of it doesn't mean that drugs aren't going through. It's just a stable region for them.
Exactly. And as you get closer and closer to the border, you'll find evidence of isolated events that if these occurred inside the Beltway, for example, you would have national news media covering this. For this week alone, we've had UT, University of Texas, Pan American girl that either was a employee or a staff member or just walking through the campus that was kidnapped on the campus in an express kidnapping. She was released unharmed. Fortunately, but the kidnappers demanded a payment to a location in Reynosa, Mexico.
Hmm.
And we also had a report yesterday of a bomb, specifically a hand grenade that was uncovered on one of the major international bridges that kind of shut down traffic back and forth. Now, you take both of those kinds of incidents and you put them in a more mainstream media markets, you would have a lot of interest, and this is just kind of a daily event for those of us here in Texas that are around the border.
Right.
So, you know, there are great concerns here in the law enforcement community that as I go across the country, pushing more and more north of just the encroachment of some of these gangs into the United States and their control over the actual supply chain into the U.S.
It's a daunting situation, and I don't necessarily know. Would you say that there are enough law enforcement? I know we talk about this all the time, Fred. Are there enough law enforcement resources or federal resources being dedicated to this issue? I mean, with the, you know, with some of the National Guard units and maybe some of the military units coming back, You know, do we really do need to rededicate energy to this? Because it seems as if some of the cartels are just kind of running around almost unchecked.
Well, they really are, and there's a tremendous corruption aspect on both sides of the border affecting this issue, Derek. The biggest challenge for law enforcement entities along the border is that, how do you eliminate corruption? How do you herd all the cats, all the different federal partners and state and local agencies, to get them all in sync? How do you know that the person that you're sharing information with is not on the cartel payrolls?
Right.
The money involved in this business far exceeds what most people's, as you can imagine, the amount of money that's being made in this business. You look at geography. I recently just drove the border for some informational meetings, and you get into areas along the border where it's so rural that it's almost impossible to kind of secure and control. And that's where the concepts of, well, if we had a border fence would stop this. Well, first off, it would take probably 25 years to build one.
Right.
And secondly, you don't have the resources there to staff it, even if you did have a fence.
And even if you put the electronic resources on there, I mean, it would still take somebody time to get there. By that time, the person could have disappeared. And you also have people driving tunnels underground these days. I mean, they're so, it seems as if the cartels are sometimes just a step ahead of our law enforcement and military in terms of what they're doing. The submarines, the tunnels. It's amazing about how many different things. I was even wondering, are they going to start using drones to get stuff over next? It's kind of crazy, Fred.
Well, there's no shortage of aircraft that comes in too. Small planes with extended fuel bladders that are inside these small aircraft. They fly under the radar through the mountains and come into the United States and kind of pop up in the airstream. You have hang gliders. You have a tremendous number of just old-fashioned backpack foot mules that come in. The efficiency in the process is really interesting. I've watched a lot of this on surveillance videotape, and it's really amazing to watch. The state of Texas has, in essence, also acquired some patrol vessels to drive the Rio Grande to try to help interdict in some of these efforts as well. They're doing a real good job in interdiction efforts, but what you'll notice, too, is you can flood an area for a 24- or 36-hour period, and then the moment that you leave, the drug flow just continues.
It pops right back up, yeah.
Their intelligence network is very, very robust, with a series of lookouts inside the United States that most people, again, don't understand, that the border is something that really kind of encroaches into the United States, where you have patches of geography to include cities where they have lookouts that are very attuned to outsiders coming in, so you can't put a lot of undercover resources in. So it is a national security challenge to be able to come up with a solution for this problem.
Fred, it's something we have to keep on thinking about, and we're out of time. I wish we always had time to talk about it more, but this is one of those, as we've mentioned a couple times, about another daunting problem hopefully, as, and we got to deal with the international piece, but this is international as well, but this is international directly in our backyard. And it's something that we definitely need to keep our eye on. Thank you so much for the input, Fred. We're going to be checking back with you probably next month to see how things are going. Thank you so much for being on Fed Access.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me, as always.
You've been listening to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear it in its entirety on our website, federalnewsradio.com. Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch, Friday afternoons at noon, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, WFED, your source for federal news now.